He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns. Well, hello again. Today I am talking with Matt Frodsham, a UK-based motion designer who has some of the weirdest and coolest stuff on his reel I've ever seen. You should check out the bird piece that's on his website. It's weird and awesome. And it's really not surprising that his work has this quality because Matt has worked extensively with one of the coolest, weirdest, and most unique studios in the world, Zeitgeist, based out of Berlin. In this interview, Matt and I talk about how his career has ended up the way that it has and what it means to actually have a, quote, career in this field. Because, you know, it can be very different for different people. And we talk about goals, work-life balance, and burnout. It's a really interesting conversation with a very interesting artist. And I think that you'll get a cool look at just one way a motion design career can look. And hopefully you'll learn some tricks for managing your own work-life balance and things like that. So let's get into it. Matt, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy, busy schedule to talk to us. And I'm really excited to dig into your career a little bit, man.
Yes, thanks. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Yeah, no problem.
Be exciting.
So, you know, most of the work that's on your site was produced when you were on staff, I guess, at Zeitgeist in Germany. And I'm curious because, you know, Zeitgeist, at least in America, it's not one of the studios that you hear as much about. You know, everyone's heard of Buck and PSYOP and Shiloh and places like that, but a lot of people haven't heard of Zeitgeist. So how did you become familiar with them?
First of all, I wasn't really staff, but yeah, and I got into them when I was in college, and it was college. It wasn't even university yet. And I was kind of getting into After Effects and Cinema 4D when I was on my design course. Like, it was a graphic design course, so I wasn't doing any animation or anything in the standard kind of projects I was doing. But then I started to get into it, and I started to get into reading Motionographer and all of these cool blogs that were happening at the time. And it just kind of hit at exactly the right time where their film called Peripatetics from, I think it was 2009, kind of just popped up on Motionographer, and it just blew my mind, like, what it even was. Because it was in between all of these commercial projects from the likes of PSYOP and Book, who were obviously, like, that was the gold standard, still is the gold standard of kind of what you want to achieve in commercial work. But then there was just this crazy film with amazing visuals and unbelievable sound that was just this standalone experience that was not advertising something, and it was just like, oh, you can do other things with this, it's not just adverts. So that kind of really turned me on to them.
Yeah, it's, I mean, when I went to the Zeitgeist website and I'm looking at it, and I would even say this to some degree about your website too, there's so much beautiful work on it that I can't figure out what the client is. You know, like, I come from a really pretty standard client paying you to promote their brand kind of, yep, motion design world, and Zeitgeist seems like almost the opposite of that. And their work, aside from being sort of non-commercial, it's also really bizarre and weird in this great way. And so I was curious, and, you know, since you were there for so long, is that an intentional thing that they're doing over there? Or is that just, you know, the people who started Zeitgeist have really strange thoughts going on in their head? Like, where does that come from?
I think it's a bit of both. It's good that you mentioned the website. If you look at Zeitgeist's website, there is literally, at this point in time, there is no commercial work on it. It is art projects, and they leave the commercial work to be published by their reps and by the guys who make it, like me, so we can get more work. But they don't outwardly advertise themselves as, I think there's one MTV thing there. But I think that speaks to the larger concept of putting forward the work that you want to be known by. Like, you know, they do commercial work, but it's not there to be seen.
Yeah. I was going to ask, like, how, what, what's the balance over there of, you know, every studio has a balance of work that they do to pay the bills and then the work that they do to get the work they want. Mm-hmm. And what was kind of the balance over there? Was it half and half, or was it, is there a lot more work that we're not seeing?
I don't hide projects until they're quite old. Like, there's nothing that I work on usually that doesn't get published. And I would say it's probably 50-50. Like, it's not often that there's nothing commercial going on, but because there's a few guys that are working, like, they kind of split it. You know, there's busy periods and there's quiet periods as gotcha. Everyone has. But.
And without, you know, giving away any clients' names or brand names or anything like that, I mean, you know, what's the level of slumming it that Zeitgeist will have to, you know, dip to? Like, are they doing end tags for fast food restaurants, you know, to pay the bills so that they can make, you know, like the amazing weird birds piece or something like that? Like, is it, or is it a little higher end than that?
It's a little higher end than that, especially now. They're turning down jobs left and right. It's they can really pick and choose, I think.
That's amazing. It's really inspiring to see a studio kind of start out a little bit under the radar like that. And then you go to their website, and I'm looking at it right now. I mean, there's nothing on it. There's really nothing on it with a brand. It's just, it's pretty amazing. Awesome. So was the weirdness of, you know, that piece you saw, Parapleptics?
Parapeptic.
I'm going to have to like look up that word in the dictionary. Was that something that attracted you specifically to Zeitgeist?
Yeah, definitely. I was learning Cinema 4D at the time, and I had no idea that this thing was made in Cinema 4D. It was like, once I got there as an intern and I started digging around the files, it was like, it's not that outrageous. It's just rendered in V-Ray and has very good design. But yeah, I think this film specifically was what drew me to it. There was some other really nice stuff that they were doing with like Boolean camera concepts, where like they were taking Turbo Squid models and like using the camera as a geometry and stuff like this. This was also really interesting. And these kind of zoo characters that were very abstract forms, and they were just crazy. So yeah, it was all just really off the wall and really exciting. And I was like, yeah, that sounds
like a fun gig. And so you started as an intern there, correct?
Yeah.
How much Cinema 4D, how much After Effects did you know before you ended up working there?
I probably knew more After Effects than I do now. And
that's great.
I knew a good bit of cinema. Like, I'd made it my goal during the last year of university to like become proficient enough to be hired for like decent jobs. Like, I still suck. Like, when I look at the work that I had back then, I'm still not sure what drew them to me. But I could, you know, I could navigate and I could get around, scene file, but you know, nowhere near as much as I know now, obviously.
Right. And were there mentors there that were teaching you this, or was it really just an environment that you could explore in?
Yeah, I think the latter, definitely. Henrik, the director, he was he's really an explorer in the software. Like, he's not sitting doing tutorials and learning the software inside out. He just likes doing exactly what you can do in cinema, which is just plug things into other things, and then group them and plug them into something else and then deform them and clone to it. And like, I think once you step out of the kind of standard Cinema 4D learning path, if you just ignore all that and just get into it, that you can make super interesting stuff, like even just with the basic tools.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with that 100%. And, you know, I talked about this with Nates and Rich. You know, that's the best part about Cinema 4D is that you can just jump right in and start connecting pieces together and getting weird stuff. But that's also the problem. and you know, I'm looking at your work, you know, specifically there was a music video that you did From Hell. And by the way, are you like a metalhead, or like was that just that band happened to ask you to do this?
No, yeah, I'm punk hardcore kid.
Nice, that's awesome, man. Me too. So, nice. You know, and I'm looking at that, and there was some modeling and some rigging of animals and quadrupeds and stuff in there. You know, so there's some fairly complex but typical 3D problems you had to solve, and those are the types of things that a lot of Cinema 4D artists kind of. They get away with not knowing, like how to model properly, mm-hmm. and how to rig and paint weights and actually do proper character animation. So where did you learn that stuff?
I tried to learn that stuff. I'm actually terrible at it. Character rigging, weighting, and that specific video. There's so much hidden that I can explain shortly, but. The usual places like C4D Cafe and Digital Tutors and these kind of places with really strong backgrounds to learn the real nuts and bolts of cinema, I think, are good. I was probably more than I am now, I was always wanting to learn everything about cinema. Like, I thought I should have knowledge of every part of it. Like, I started to really learn or try to learn espresso at some point, but now I've just kind of admitted that, well, you can get along with knowing half of it very well, probably. And then if you need someone specific to do something like very specialized, then there's always somebody there to help.
Yeah, it's definitely true. It's interesting how many people I ask some question like, hey, so where did you learn to do this? And they say, I don't know how to do that, actually. I just fake it very well.
Yeah, totally. Like this From Hell video, like it's basically crappy turbo squid models that I took into this sculpting program called 3D Coat, which is really weird voxel sculpting. Like, it's not at all like ZBrush. You can do whatever you want. You don't have to worry about the mesh. And so all the meshes are just exported super high density. Like, it's ridiculous. If you click on an object, it's white with mesh density. and then I just make like these crappy proxy meshes for it and weight them roughly. And then it's, you know, it's all faked. I have no idea how to do character animation, to be honest.
Well, that's amazing, because, you know, there was another piece, and I think this was probably the piece that I saw that made me go, whoa, this guy really knows what he's doing, was the birds piece.
Yeah.
And I think in part of the process write up for that you did, you talked about like looking at reference of birds and trying to match their movement. Mm-hmm. And you really nailed it. I mean, all of those funny, the eggs one, it might be my favorite. But I mean, it really looks like birds. And to me, you know, I'm not a character animator. It looks like, wow, you really understand how characters move. But you're saying that you don't? I mean, you just sort of, was it just brute force to make it work?
Absolutely brute force. Yeah. brute force render, brute force animation. It was really just copying it. From the reference very closely, otherwise you don't get that very close familiarity with the whatever creature it may be, whether it's birds or humans or whatever. I think that if you're going to try and make something that has some semblance of its original form, then you need to be really close to it. So it's not really like I was animating even. It, like, people were asking if it was motion captured, if we had some kind of little... tiny bird suits with
right
very tiny ping pong balls right. On
painting little dots on the birds and
that's we really, did plan to do a shoot at some point with
yeah I, it's really it's amazing how much you can get away with just by sort of hacking your way through various problems like this. That's really that's really funny, because I mean, I the way I would look at it is, oh, I need to learn how birds move, and you're saying I don't know how birds move. I just literally went frame by frame and like made it match the video.
Yeah. Passively you get a feel for it, like you know if it looks right or not after the fact. And I did become at some point, if you look at the making of, before we broke it all down into these abstractions, like there were pretty anatomically correct birds, like we had to rig them and stuff. So I did get a good understanding of the bird's anatomy and things, you know, to a certain extent.
Right, right. Gotcha. And so that project, that birds project, how long did that take from start to finish?
Yes. No. from actual starting point conceptually to finish, yes. But it was a good few months, I think, on and off. It was not a commercial project, so it was one of these on and off things. But I would we spent a decent amount of time on it. It wasn't a rush. No.
And so you know, at a company like Zeitgeist, how does a project like that start? Like, where does it come from? Does someone just wake up and say, "I had the weirdest dream"? There were these eggs. where does that come from?
The initial concept started from a pitch from years and years ago, and it was for, we can't remember if it was for MTV or Viva, but like it was for an ident for a TV channel, and it was one of the kind of starting points. And the project went a different way, and the birds kind of sat there on the shelf for a while, and we were like, oh, we should probably finish that project because it was a really nice idea. And the concept initially was a bit different from how it turned out, so we're not afraid of letting that evolve organically if it turns out to be something slightly different to what it was first envisioned. So that's nice.
That's great. And so I'm looking at some of the MTV stuff that Zeitgeist has done, and you know, MTV, I could be wrong, but I'm guessing they're one of those clients that doesn't come at you with a giant bag of money, but mm-hmm. they give you a lot of creative freedom. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's still kind of near the top of my site, this MTV charts from, I think it's 2011.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely one of my favorite projects I've worked on there, because it started with this, with a reference to I think it was an art project, basically art science crossover by Carl Sims. And he kind of had these generative little creatures that would evolve themselves. And we kind of took the concept from this, from the movement. So these little creatures would kind of, all these day-to-day struggles and try and get through life and then inject some humor into it. Right. So it started off with like a strong artistic concept that wasn't then diluted by the client. It was like, it was just pushed further visually. And then it got to this really enjoyable comedy piece that still had kind of artistic merit from the concept. So that's really, really a nice project.
Yeah. It's, that one's really, really fun to watch too. And I'm sure it was really fun to kind of mess around with the technique of how you were going to animate. And I'm sure a lot of that was done with dynamics and stuff like that.
Yeah. It was all dynamic. Yeah. It was kind of when all the motors and constraints and things first came out for cinema. So we were playing around with all the new toys and inventing new things with them. So
it's a good excuse to like play around with that stuff too. That's awesome. So, you know, one thing I'm curious about too is, you know, if you're working at a company that, you know, has to pay the bills, and so you're doing work that doesn't end up on the site, but at the same time, you're constantly trying to finish these art projects or these kind of passion projects. You know, you probably have to start and stop and start and stop. And when you do that, is that like, how frustrating is that? Or is that just the nature of the game? And that's something that you learn to deal with when you're trying to finish the project that keeps the lights turned on, but you're also trying to finish the project that you want to finish.
Yeah, I think they're pretty good at scheduling decent blocks of time to step away from commercial work and get it done. So there's not too much of that, but at the same time, especially with personal work on top of the art projects, on top of the other commercial work, then that gets a bit hard to deal with if you're trying to do too much at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty amazing. So you're saying that, you know, the executive producer of Zeitgeist would actually say no to clients. We cannot do this job for you that you're willing to pay us for because we have these naked models that we're chopping their legs off and putting you know, like that would happen.
I mean, I can't speak for the internal business structure of it, but I'm pretty sure that's essentially what's happening here.
That's I mean, that's really awesome, and I could be wrong, but I would suspect that's pretty rare too. I mean, I can tell you in my own experience, it's very hard to turn down paying jobs. It takes a lot of confidence to do that.
Yeah.
To know that they'll come back later.
So yeah, I mean, this is something now that I'm dealing with as a like a real freelancer now that I've kind of moved countries and I'm kind of chasing, or not chasing, being chased.
Yes. That was a perfect segue, by the way. Very nice. Well done. So let's talk about that. So what made you decide to, you know, after I think you said 5 years at Zeitgeist, what made you decide to leave and move back to the UK?
Yeah, it was really more about moving to the UK. Like I still haven't really left. I'm doing a project with them right now from the UK. But it was more a case of me and my partner wanted to kind of get a house as opposed to living in a flat in the middle of a capital city. It always feels so temporary to me, like all of these distractions and things where you kind of feel guilty for then not taking advantage of everything that's there. And you're like, oh, but you live in a place where people go on holiday to. It's like, yeah, but I still want to sit at home and play video games sometimes. So kind of moving to a quieter area where we can go to the city is kind of a nice prospect for me.
Yeah, it's interesting because I went through something very similar, and a lot of my friends, you know, I'm 34. A lot of my friends are around the same age, and they're starting to, you know, get a little disillusioned with like the New York City lifestyle or the Los Angeles lifestyle. And it sounds like you kind of went through the, you know, the Europe version of that. You're in Berlin, which I've never been to, but I'm imagining is a probably pretty big city with a lot going on. And where do you live now?
Just outside of Manchester in England. It's kind of a little suburb and 10 minutes away on the train. So I never wanted to go to London, which is kind of the equivalent of New York. Like it's very, very busy, very dense. All of the work is there in, yep, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, the good thing is you don't really need to. And this is something I guess would be interesting to get your perspective on. You are not a rookie, so you're not starting out. And I think that puts you in a position where it almost doesn't matter where you live now, because you can do the work and communicate with clients remotely. For someone starting out, do you think that they should still probably try to get set up in a big city surrounded by motion design studios?
Yeah, I think so. Or at least the studio should spread out a little bit as well. But yeah, I think it's really, really important to get the community thing. Like you can only learn so much from the internet. Like you can learn a lot from the internet, and you can learn a lot from making your own mistakes and things. But until you're in a room with guys that have been doing it longer or even a shorter amount of time, but are much better than you, or with different skills or with different ways of doing things, I think it's really important to spend time in studios. And I still look forward to doing that now. Like I love working from home because I like to get my head down and chill and do my own thing. But I also really like going to a studio and seeing, you know, what's going on other people's screens and in other people's lives and things.
Right. And I, you know, also if you're starting out and you've never worked with people like that, then there are things that you physically, it's impossible to learn on the internet, like how to deal with clients, how to work with budgets and stuff like that. Were you part of those conversations at Zeitgeist talking about budgets and schedules and stuff like that?
Not really. Well, the schedules obviously came into it because they needed to know how long things took.
How long does it take to to make a weird bird out of eggs, Matt? Tell me.
Yeah, longer than you would think.
Exactly. So, because, you know, when you start freelancing, all of a sudden you are the producer as well. And so do you feel like, you know, your experience at Zeitgeist prepared you well for that and talking about budgets and things like that?
Yeah, I think especially one of the things I learned about during my time was just how projects work and what people do in the industry. Like before I got there, I didn't know what a producer was. I didn't know what an art director was. I didn't know what an advertising agency was in relation to a design studio, in relation to a production company, in relation to the client. Like as a student, you work for a theoretical client all the time. It's like, oh, you make a fake advert for Nike or whatever. Like,
right.
So then to kind of go from 0 to 100 is like, oh, okay. Like, I don't know what any of these people are doing. There's a lot of people making a lot of money in the advertising industry. And it's like, oh, what did they all do? Like, but now after you spend a few years, you realize how important all the pieces are of the puzzle and kind of understand how things work.
Yeah, I'd say producers especially, that's one of those things that until you start working and you get to work with both good producers and bad producers, and then you realize just how amazing a good producer is, like in a project.
Totally.
Yeah.
Become very defensive of your producer. It's like the quarterback, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. So now that you are freelance, so how long have you been freelance? Is it pretty recent?
It's been years, actually.
Oh, wow, okay.
Just have kind of failed to do any work for anybody else. you know, if somebody's offering you work like that, you're going to turn it down.
Of course. Well, it becomes... So this is an interesting thing I want to get your opinion on. So, you know, as a freelancer, there's a lot of different forces that kind of fight for your attention. So you've got... I really want to work with this studio. It's been my dream to work with them. But then at the same time, I've got this client that, you know, like I will never put anything I do for them on my reel, but they give you giant, giant checks. Mm-hmm. And how are you juggling that? Because it sounds like Zeitgeist had a pretty good system for juggling those different forces. And how has that been for you?
I mean, since I got back, it's only been a few months and there was a lot of... time off with actually moving countries and stuff. So I've kind of been fortunate to run into really nice studios already here in the UK, as well as doing a project with Zeitgeist as well. So I can't really speak too much to doing the kind of work that just pays the bills. Like I'm turning down studios that I want to work with already, absolutely, but not in the place of crappy work. The worry always for me with something like that is if you say no too many times to somebody who you want to work with, do they then stop asking? And then do they just see you as the guy who's always busy and has got no time for you? So that's my concern. Like there was one day a few weeks ago when three studios, all of who I would really, really want to work with, all emailed within 3 hours. I was like, oh, come on.
I know. And you know, you must be already starting to have those thoughts like percolating, like, where's this going? Maybe I should start, you know, Fraud Shim Studios or something. Like, do you have any sort of ambitions to start your own studio? Like, what's your 10-year plan?
I wish I had a good answer for this. And so does everybody else who knows me. No, I'm really crap at planning things. I just kind of see how the cards play out. I mean,
it's definitely a good problem to have too many awesome studios calling you. And so, you know, I have my theories, but I'm curious, you know, there's a lot of artists out there who would love to be in that position where you have so many studios calling you, you have to turn them down and you're still able to do work that is interesting and isn't, you know, explainer videos for like your local bank or something. Mm-hmm. Although I don't know, maybe you are doing those and you're just not telling anybody, but, but if you had to guess, what do you think it is about your portfolio or your approach that's getting you this work?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, let's take a few steps back. I don't have tons of studios always hammering down the door. Like I think it's, I'm very fortunate to have worked with Zeitgeist because that's been a big platform. And then, you know, I keep my portfolio, you know, kind of current. I'm terrible at blogging and terrible at keeping things up to date. I only update it a few times a year. So, I mean, hopefully it's just the portfolio. Like, I think it should just be about the work really at the end of the day.
Are you, are you booked basically every single day that you want to be booked, or have there been, you know, weeks where no one's called and you haven't been booked?
I've not had any weeks off yet. The minute I landed, I had a job lined up and I bought a new computer for it, actually. And it kind of got postponed. So I'm sat there with a lot of money going out and nothing coming in for the first week or so of being in the UK. So I'm like, this is a tough start, but it all falls into place.
I read the blog post about that computer, by the way. I recommend everyone does that. It's really interesting. Incredibly dorky.
it keeps the house warm.
Nice.
There's ups and downs already. Even I have definitely been steady so far. But even this week on Monday, I'm working on a job. On Monday, I was rendering, you know, final HD frames. And on Tuesday morning, I got an email and it's like, oh, this thing's on hold now. We don't know what's happening. So, you know, things happen.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that ever stops. That sort of landmine. All right. So it sounds like you are pretty busy. Maybe there's some little peaks and valleys. And are you still trying to fit in personal projects or passion projects, you know, working with Zeitgeist or people like that in the downtime?
I go through phases, actually. I don't force myself to try and make something. I'm a big fan of these, like, for example, Beeple with his everydays. It's just insane, like, how we can commit to this. But I've always got ideas on the back burner. I'm not currently working on anything. I still feel like I'm kind of hitting the ground running and sorting everything out after the move. But in theory, yes, I am working in practice.
Yeah. One of the things that I've struggled with, I'm sure a lot of people have, probably most motion designers, is, when you're working and working and working, and a lot of what we do, it's mentally very intense, figuring out things and not being sure you're going to get it and that sort of stuff, and not being sure the client's going to like it, is feeling a bit burnt out. And you mentioned this is something that you've talked about in the past, and I'm curious, if you've sort of figured out some ways to help yourself avoid burning out and to always be able to approach a project, you know, from like a fresh perspective and not with like this sense of dread in your stomach.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of snapped about, I think it was 2 years ago. And the thing is, it's called burnout. It creeps up on you. It's a slow burn. It's not something you can even notice and correct until it's in my experience, I couldn't correct it until it was way too late and it had already impacted my life negatively. Like it's something you can read a million blog posts about and see people, you know, write about it and speak about it, but still you're like, oh, I'll be fine. Like I'm working on really nice projects. I want to be doing this. It's fine. But then at some point it's not fine. It doesn't matter what you're doing. It doesn't matter how awesome the projects are that you're working on. It doesn't matter who you're with or whatever. It can still build up. And the conversation now might take a dark turn as opposed to all the jokes so far. When I did my first talk at a university last year, at my old university, I think it bummed everybody out talking about it. They're like, oh, shit.
It's sometimes you got to give them the tough medicine, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you try and warn people. They're not going to listen, you know. And I think it starts in university because you have to do so much. And even in earlier than that in school, but in university, you're studying, you're trying to kind of do your projects for university. You're trying to learn the software that you're not being taught. You're trying to make money working at a bar or by doing other freelance gigs or whatever. So you kind of get used to always doing something, always working, always kind of scraping, whatever. And then you kind of get to the next stage, which is the last stage apart from retirement. That's the other thing. It's like you hit the final stage of life in your early 20s and you're like, oh, this is it now. And you're like, oh, I've got all of this potential free time. Like if I go to work in the morning and I come home in the evening and like I've got no homework, I've got no bar to go and work at. It's like now I can make all of the things that I've been wanting to make. Like I can help my friends out, like you and I are into punk and hardcore. So there's all of these, we've got friends in bands and things, and you see your friends sleeping in a van or whatever. And you're like, well, I could probably help them out with music video or album artwork and stuff like that. So you kind of try and kind of give a bit back to your friends, and your like family ask you for little things, and then you kind of do all of these collaborations, and then there's only so much time you can spend. And more importantly, there's only so much energy you can spend. It's not even just the time. Like you can be awake from 7 a.m. till 3 a.m. But there's only so much meaningful energy you can give during that period. And if you're kind of spending it too much in different places, then yeah.
I mean, to me, that you just described it perfectly. I mean, that's what burnout is. It's when, you know, I think that balance is kind of the key. And you know, there's different kinds of balance. There's the balance between, you know, very good paying client work to keep the lights on and then doing the stuff that you really care about. And then on top of that, there's your physical health, your relationship with your significant other. Yeah. I have children. So like the amount of time I spend with my children, and I have burnt out two or three times.
Oh, really?
I've been through it before. Yeah. It's very easy if you have a certain type of personality, I think.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, you like, I don't know, maybe you sometimes feel this way where it's like a Wednesday and you're not booked and you feel like I should be doing something.
Yeah.
I should be working on my reel. No, you could just go outside, go for a walk. Like
that's
an option. You know, you could do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially growing up here when it's like kind of very working class, everybody works 9 to 5 and then that's it. So, but nobody works after that, but you still have this kind of guilt. If you're at home on a Wednesday like today and I'm sat at home at 3 p.m. and it's like, I kind of feel like PlayStation, but that's not what you're allowed to do as a grown-up. Like you should be doing something now, even if you were working till 2 a.m. the night before.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, the older I get, the less I want to be part of the traditional kind of work, like the idea of what work is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it, like, even, you know, I'm sure when you meet people and they say, oh, hi, Matt, hey, what do you do? And you have to explain what you do. It's like, well, I mean, that's just what I do to like pay my bills. But what I really like to do is this, you know, and I think that, you know, I found that you feel better and burnout goes away, you know, pretty quickly if you balance the things that you love and that make you feel good with the things that you feel obligated to do.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So when you feel, you know, when you've gotten burnt out, like what are some of the things that it's done to you? And you don't have to get too personal, but just in general, like what does it do?
It very quickly turns very nice projects into like something that you dread to work on. Like, cause if you were working on something else the night before and you go in the morning, and even if, like, I think it even happened at the beginning of the kind of the stages of Birds, like it was something really, really fun to work on. And I was just like, I can't do it. I can't look at a computer. And it was kind of during commercial projects, kind of letting things get to me more than they usually would. And kind of taking out on people, not in a violent way, but
right.
Like, you know, kind of a mean passive aggressive comment here and there, like just when you're frustrated with something and it like really, it was really not something that I wanted to be doing, but, it was really tough. The positive thing that came out of it was that was the point when I was officially freelance then, because I talked to Henrik and I was like, I need to kind of change something in my life to, like, I can't not do other projects, but I can't not work for you at the same time. So he was like, well, just work less. Just, that's as simple as that. Like we had a nice talk about it and you know, we talked about stuff, but the short answer was just stop working so much, you idiot. Which was kind of a revelation. I was like, oh, I can do that. Like, so, you know, then I took time out to make a music video, for example. And yeah, and also the realization that the commercial work is just that. Often, especially with Zeitgeist, like the art projects kind of inform the commercial work eventually at some point, hopefully. But sometimes it's just a dumb advert, and you can look at it like that. You can go in with all the energy, and it can be a really fun job to make, but it doesn't have to be the best thing you've ever made, and it doesn't have to have some cultural significance, or it doesn't matter. Like, it's just an advert. Like this latest one, this Sun Bingo that Nate's worked on for a short time, coincidentally. It's just a bingo advert. It doesn't matter what it is. Like, we put a lot of effort into it, and it looks nice, and it animates well, and, you know, but its sole purpose is to get working class people to give some money across and have fun and play bingo. So.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, when you're starting out, 'cause I think that's one of those things that you learn from experience, that you need to be able to let go. And when the client says, yeah, you know, we really need you to put this big block of type on that umbrella,
yeah,
you know, and oh, you know, the logo's not big enough, you need to make it bigger. You have to learn how to let it go, because in your head, you're like, I just spent a month on this, yeah, and the composition of that end tag is perfect. Yeah. Now you're throwing off my balance. And was that ever a struggle for you, sort of letting go of the commercial stuff and not taking it so personally?
Yeah, totally. Especially when starting out, and you're kind of almost taking charge of these big commercial projects, like the Bank Popular adverts. Like, they got really heavy really fast. They started out as kind of really weird, fun things, and then they went into like real adverts, like something PSYOP would be doing, and they're like, oh, this is a lot of work now. And yeah, they were a tough client. Oh, it was the agency, really, the agency and then the client, because the client was a cooperative kind of round table of people, so everybody put their 2 cents in. I don't really like green. It was one of these kind of funny.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, but eventually you learn that that's just what happens, and you can laugh about it, and it is what it is.
Yeah. What's your favorite type of client to work with? Like, you know, you can work with an ad agency, or you can work directly with the owner of a company, or you could work with, like, the lead singer of a band. Like, who, in your experience, like, who do you like working with the most?
I think the direct-to-client is usually the best. In my experience as a designer, like, maybe it doesn't make the most money, so my opinion may change on that as I get older. But creatively, they, for example, MTV, they just let you do whatever you want, usually within certain boundaries. If you don't have an ad agency kind of stepping in the way with the creative directors, and, you know, they need to make themselves useful somehow.
Justify their existence. Yeah, I that's kind of a stereotype. I've worked with a lot of ad agencies, and, you know, it's like with anything, there's really great creative directors, and then there's ones that, you know, probably somebody's nephew or something. So your portfolio, you know, and the clients you're working with, really, really great, really high end. And so, you know, from, you know, if I take a step back and I say, you know, 25-year-old Joey looking at this would be like, oh my God, this guy's made it. This is what it looks like when you make it as a motion designer. Now, I think I know the answer to this, but do you feel like you've made it, Matt? Do you feel like your career is exactly where you want it to be right now?
Well, that's two questions. I don't think I've made it, but my career is probably where I would want it to be. I don't think you can ever make it. Like, what is that? Like, it's different things to different people, isn't it?
Right. I mean, you know, like, and that's kind of an interesting thing too, because you mentioned Beeple.
Yes.
Beeple's one of these guys where it's like, everyone who does motion design knows who Beeple is. Everyone knows about his everydays. Has he made it? Like, It's a weird question. I'm not sure what the right answer is, but you know, I guess it comes down to what, like, what's the goal? Like, what's your goal with your career? Is it to make a lot of money? Is it to just keep pushing your skills? Like, what, like, I don't know, because I sort of have my goals, but I'm curious, like, what your goals are.
I'm not super driven by money. I just want enough to live, like, do the things that I want to do. But I think I want to make, you know, enough art projects to satisfy that creative need and make enough money to do it. It's just kind of short, simple answer. I don't know.
So the plan is to keep freelancing, keep working with new clients and kind of see what happens.
Yeah.
Nice. It's a good plan. So another thing I wanted to ask you about, Matt, is on your site, you have a section called How.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got some pretty in-depth and really kind of blown out how-tos. You know, there's one on Cinema 4D scene speed, which, I mean, as far as I could tell, is probably the best, most, you know, elaborate source of this information on the internet. Why do you make these things?
It depends which things. The Cinema 4D scene speed I made because I was pissed off with everybody complaining about how slow cinema was. And I'm like, it's not. You're just using it wrong. You're just not putting enough effort into it.
Right.
The other things, these kind of making ofs, they kind of just are left over from university, really. Like, you know, you have to kind of keep documents of everything you do in university, especially when you were doing what I was doing, which was stepping outside of the regular graphic design class. And I wasn't there as often as the other guys. So I was kind of having to show you're working out.
Right.
So I was keeping these blogs as opposed to like a sketchbook. I imagine everybody's doing it now, but I was kind of... you know, this was how I was interacting with my tutors at the time. And it was like kept very regular blogs about what I was doing with the project. So I kind of got into it like that. And they were often equally as popular as the actual projects. And now I think it's just a nice way of giving back a little bit without having to make tutorials or anything, because I'm totally not into that. But I am appreciative of everybody who does things like that. And I think it's nice to share, you know, share what you can. Also, it lets people know that you know what you're talking about in some respects. Like, you can put a project on your website, but you may have only, like, modeled a suitcase in the corner or something.
Right.
I really made this.
Yes. Yeah. That's kind of what I guessed. Because, you know, when I taught at, there's a college down here in Florida where I live called the Ringling College of Art and Design. And when I taught there, the students in the motion design program, especially the seniors, were asked to do exactly what you've done and do these making of sort of blog posts to accompany the final project. And I think it's brilliant as a way of getting more work too. I mean, it's real. I mean, you know, yeah. People like me and people who want to learn from you are super appreciative of it because you learn from it. But a studio also, it's like, you know, if they're looking at you, they might be looking at two other really good Cinema 4D artists. And so what's going to make the difference between who they hire? Well, you can document your process. They can see how you problem solve and how you work through an issue, and they can see how you iterated. And that gives an employer so much more confidence. So I would urge everyone who's listening to this to do the same. It's really a smart thing to do. And yeah. So Matt, you said you have no interest in in ever doing tutorials or anything like that, right?
No, certainly not on the internet. I did a brief, like, 2-day course with some students last year, which I kind of enjoyed. So I wouldn't rule out teaching in general, but I think that we're at saturation now with people far better than me at teaching on the internet. I have no place there.
Yeah, I'm curious because obviously this is something that I think about quite a bit. Like, you know, how do you teach something like this on the internet? And are there any resources out there that you think are, you know, and you like, you don't have to say School of Motion, you can say but like what resources are out there that you think are, you know, like if you were starting out and you wanted to learn, you know, what you know now, where would you start?
That's a good question. When I started out, I think I did spend a lot of time on Grayscale Gorilla before it got super big and got this unfair negative connotation with it.
Right.
Like Nick really, really helped put things into a practical space for me. Like, you know, cinema doesn't have to be this crazy technical thing to overcome. You can just go in and start making things. So that's a good starting point. I think if you want to spend a little bit of money, then Digital Tutors is very comprehensive. And it covers most of the software, like within one space. Mm-hmm. So that's cool. I started with Lynda as well when I was doing After Effects, which was very dry. Like, I didn't. I enjoyed some of it, but a lot of the tutors were very cut and dry. Like, this is what this tool does. This is what this tool does. So that was a bit. I don't know if I could recommend that. But this, like. There's so much everywhere now, right? It's
yeah, and I mean, you know, because I think that all of those resources that you talk about, they're very, I mean, especially Grayscale, really like amazing ways of learning, you know, mostly technical skills with some of the kind of ways of developing your eye. But like when you look at your work, you know, and you look at, you know, like the Do the Math video. There's some, you know, there's some really smart color choices and design choices and things like that that are much tougher to learn online. And I'm curious if you think that, you know, because you were a graphic design student, how important do you think that is going to be moving forward for people? Like, do you still think you have to go to school for graphic design to do this?
I don't think so. It's a good question, and it's a hard one to answer because especially if you went to school. It's hard to argue against it because everyone's like, well, you went, so, you know, you did well as well. And it really depends on what you're looking for. Like, you can, if you just need guidance or you need to learn to focus or you need the community aspect of it, it's tough to learn certain things online, but you can also learn those things in real life without going to school, I think. It's tough. I think it's really, really important now to have good design skills. Like, I really need to sharpen up on a lot of that, and especially with, like you say, with the color. I really like working with color, but I also am kind of terrible at color theory, apart from the obvious few rules that everybody needs to know. We're all still learning. As you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, forever. Never ends. So so the last thing I wanted to just ask you is, you know, I'll call out the blog post on your site where you talk about how you built this, like, this mutant PC to render Octane scenes on with, what do you have, 4 graphics cards in there? The thing's like the size of a small refrigerator. It's really big. So, you know, what skills are you focused on developing at the moment? I mean, I would guess Octane would be one of them, but are there other things that you're working on personally to try and expand, you know, your skill set?
Yeah, I think it's good to decide what you don't want to do first, and then you can kind of mold yourself in a different way. So even though there's kind of a lot of character work on my site, as I mentioned before, I'm terrible at character animation, but I don't want to get necessarily good at it. So a lot of people are always asking for particles. So I bought X particles and I still haven't had time to really sit down and learn it. So I'm mainly interested in kind of learning how to do interesting things with that next, probably, which has really nice Octane integration. So I believe, So that's nice.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I actually just did my first project with X Particles, and I really loved it. It's really. I don't know if you ever tried to learn thinking particles.
Oh yeah,
I did, and I gave up really, really fast.
That's why there's no particles on my site.
Yeah. And so let's talk about just really quickly too, like, because you've mentioned After Effects and how you know less After Effects now than you used to.
Oh, man, yeah.
You know, I do so much of, like, you know, when talking to Rich and Nate, you know, both of them are guys that they try to nail the look in the beauty pass.
Yeah.
I'm the opposite. I try to give myself as many opportunities to fix it in composite as possible. Right. How do you tend to work? Do you do a lot of compositing?
No, I'm with the other guys. All in camera. Bit of correction at the end. Bit of motion blur if we can't afford it in the Octane render or whatever. But it's getting so fast to do things. Like, especially depth of field now. It looks so amazing when you can do depth of field in a render and not really add any minutes to the render. I love it. In the past, I looked into multi-pass stuff a lot, and it never really excited me. I think the time is probably better spent for me, just spending more time on the actual 3D file and getting it to look nicer.
Nice. Well, I'm going to have to practice then, because you're the third person to tell me this. So. Yeah, I guess it depends what you're going for, because your work also, like those two guys, it has a lot of that kind of photorealistic quality to it. And if that's what you're going for, then you probably don't need as much compositing. You know, maybe it's just color correction, like, really.
If the renderer makes things look real, like if you're adding more reflection or more shadow, then you're making it less real. So yeah, other than a bit of color correction for this kind of polished photo real stuff, then I just leave it alone.
Awesome. Well, Matt, I want to say thank you so much for your time. I thought this was a really awesome interview, and I think people are going to learn a lot from it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. It's so funny to me that you wanted to interview me. But
if you want to see some really sick Cinema 4D work, as well as some pretty comprehensive breakdowns and how-to articles, check out Matt's work at mattfrodsham.com. And of course, anything we talked about in this interview can be found in the episode notes at schoolofmotion.com. So thank you, as always, for listening. And if you have any ideas about other artists or anybody else that you think might make an interesting interview, please let us know. You can go to schoolofmotion.com/contact and drop us a note with your idea. Rock on.